This is Ken McLeod. Thousands of people around the world listen to these podcasts every week, just as you are doing now. If you find them helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Your generosity helps us maintain and expand the website for the benefit of yourself and other practitioners worldwide. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path 2, Part 6.
Saturday, August 7th. A Trackless Path 2, Evening Session. What I'd like to do, actually, is to continue on with the questions. So where did we get to? I think you were the last one, were you, Nick? Or you didn't get... Okay, so reach behind and get the microphone.
Okay, so from the wisdom experience of ever-present good, on page 29, the top verse there.
Wow. I don't guarantee anything here. The very first verse?
Yeah.
Some use their ability to know movement as mind, to mull over the traces as thoughts and feelings ebb and flow. People who track arising and fading in stable meditation just spin in confusion, even they practice for 100 years. Yeah, it seems clear to me.
Okay. What does that mean, to track arising and fading in stable meditation?
Okay. So, you've developed the ability to let the mind rest, let's say, without distraction, without too much contrivance. You aren't trying to control your experience. So you're just sitting there. And something happens. Pop, there's a thought. And you go, oh, that was interesting. There was a thought. Ah, I've let it go, okay. Yeah, that's all right. That's called tracking. And so, oh, there was a thought, now it's gone. There was a thought, now it's gone. Oh, there's a thought, now it's gone. That's tracking. You know, tracking, arising and fading in stable meditation. You're there, but you're actually commenting and noting it. Which means that you're, even though your quality of your attention is pretty good, it's stable, by constantly doing that, you are staying in the conceptual mind. And in particular, you're staying in the observer mind. You follow? So, you never actually drop into non-conceptual awareness. And that's why he says, people who track... So you get the feeling of mulling over the traces as thoughts and feelings ebb and flow. I mean, there you are, you're sitting, oh, anger. Oh, well, that wasn't so bad. I was able to sit through that. That's kind of nice. You're mulling over your experience. You follow? How many of you have this little commentary that goes on in your meditation? Yeah, that's what we're talking about. Trungpa had a great word for it, subconscious gossip.
It's maddening because it seems like it's so pervasive.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Shut it off.
Well, the way I've often described this, that is more in the context of beginning meditation. When you first start meditation, thoughts are like elephants at a picnic. You know, there you are having a nice picnic, and the elephant herd comes in. Not too much left of the picnic after that. So you practice for a while longer, then thoughts are like dogs at a picnic. Well, and you have to fight them for the food and you get around, but you actually stay with the picnic, more or less. And then when your meditation gets more stable, it's like ants at a picnic. They're everywhere. But, yeah, there's nothing you can do about them. Now, you can't block that stuff. A lot of people try. It's like an undercurrent of chatter. As the quality of your awareness increases, you come to recognize it more and more frequently. Whenever you recognize it, place the attention. You can do that in a lot of different ways. One of them is to just hold your breath for a second. Another is to breathe out and let your attention really ride with the breath as it goes out. And at the end of the breath, there won't be any of that little chatter. Another way is to come into your body. Usually stops then. And what you're doing here is you're cutting the continuity. Any of those techniques, and there are many, many others. I'll say a word about mantra in a minute. It will stop, and then it will start again. And then there'll come a moment of recognition. And you cut it again. So you just keep cutting it. The trick here is to cut it dispassionately. Because once you get upset with it, you're screwed. So it requires a great deal of patience. So, yeah. And this is the what it means to practice meditation. You just cut, okay. The thing about practice is you're allowed to fail. It's not performance. No. You're expecting to fail. So it doesn't matter. You just cut. Starts up again. You do this over and over again. Keep dropping into that really clear, non-conceptual mind. And gradually, one forms a relationship, and now a very different quality of attention begins to develop. First, it's not so stable, but its stability comes. Now, realistically, when we're in the usual madness of our lives, could you drop that, please? The system is sufficiently churned up just by the ordinary demands of the day that there tends to be an undercurrent of that thought all the time. And so don't be upset if it's there. Just do the practice. Now, there is an important connection with mantra here, and a lot of people don't understand. And I remember Dejan Rinpoche was so inspired by Kala Rinpoche's teaching Chenrezig, because Dejan Rinpoche had been in the West for years at the University of Seattle, and nobody had ever come to study with him, or very few people. And then Kala Rinpoche came, and all these people were suddenly doing Chenrezig meditation. So this inspired him to do 100 million, to do 100 million manis before he died, which is quite a lot. And he was, you know, mid to late 60s at this point. So whenever we visited him, he was on Mani Piming, on Mani Piming, on Mani Piming. It was just all the time. The purpose of repeating a mantra all the time like this, and the same thing applies to the Jesus prayer and the Orthodox Christian tradition. You say it over and over again so that it becomes something that's just going on in you all the time. And what happens when you say it that much all the time, waking, sleeping, all the time, it replaces that subconscious gossip, and you have a still mind. That's one of the ways mantra works. And, you know, but you got to take it very seriously and just really, really do it. And it doesn't matter what the mantra is, so usually it's the shorter ones are better because the other ones take there's too much involved in just remembering them. Okay? Did that help?
Yeah, very much, thank you.
Okay. Are you next? Okay.
So, a couple of years ago, I listened to your Mahayana mind training podcasts, and I thought, this is great, and I started doing taking and sending. Then I got sick, so I did more taking and sending, and I got sicker. I had to have surgery, I had complications from surgery, so I stopped doing taking and sending, and eventually I got better. Now,
I have a slight issue with your notion of causality here.
Well, actually, that's what my question is about. So in that podcast, right, you say, taking and sending can't hurt you. That's magical thinking. Okay. But now when you present Mahamudra, right?
Mahamudra can't hurt you either.
That's fine. You make this distinction between the world of shared experience and the world of actual experience. So the world of shared experience is the way most people relate to their lives. The world of actual experience is there's no inside and outside. There's no nothing grounding experience. There's no other people, like a dream. Now, if I'm in a dream and I think about an elephant, right, very likely a dream elephant is going to appear. So if that's the way things are, it seems like magical thinking would be a totally reasonable way to approach my life. Another way...
You have some fans now.
And let me give you another way to get to the same point.
You're sounding awfully like some other Buddhist scholars I know right now. They present me with six arguments and then say, for all the same point, two of which contradict each other, and then say, what do you think? Keep going.
Okay, so I'm about to finish.
Oh, but don't announce it. You've got to work up to a nice climax.
Right. If you don't even know that I have feelings because I could be just an appearance in your dream, how can you possibly know that taking and sending won't hurt me?
So, have you seen Airbender 3? Oh, that's a pity, that's me. Airbender 3? It's a kid's movie, magical stuff. Where shall I start, Charles? Everything is a dream, right? That's what you said?
That's what you said.
But you seem to be accepting this thesis. I mean, your argument about what happened to you with taking and sending sounds like you have adopted that point of view.
Actually, I see two ways to go. And I'm not personally sure which way.
Okay, go for it.
One way is you go for this idealist understanding of emptiness, where everything literally is a dream. And then I think it's hard to avoid going to something like a traditional Tibetan world picture where there's spirits and yidams appear to people, and there's divination and magic all over the place. And that's one way. Another way is... come up with a different interpretation of emptiness, like, say, Gelugpa Madhyamaka, that doesn't have this kind of consequence.
What do you mean the Gelugpa Madhyamaka Prasangika doesn't have this kind of consequence?
So far as I can tell, and it's kind of a hard view to understand, on that view, the object, the physical object, exists in relation to the thought that knows it. The thought exists in relation to the physical object that knows it. They're mutually interdependent. Whereas if the world is a dream, there's nothing standing behind the experience. There's no ground. That seems to me to be a very different picture. In the picture where the world is a dream, literally, the mind event exists, but it's empty. The physical object is completely non-existent. It's just not there. On the way of understanding emptiness that I find in Tsongkhapa, they're both there, and they're mutually interdependent, so neither of them is real. That's not the same, so far as I can tell.
What? So, I have to pose a question here. Do you want me to answer your question from where I was at the time those recordings were made, or do you want me to answer the question from where I am now?
From where you are now, please.
Oh, okay. You're trying to determine the ontological status of experience. What did Nagarjuna have to say about that? I can ask him that question, because I know he knows.
Everybody who reads Nagarjuna has a different take on that.
What's your take? What did Nagarjuna say about trying to determine the ontological status of experience?
You think Nagarjuna said something directly about that question. Because you think cha should be translated as experience, so far as I can tell, if you translate cha as experience, you go right to the idealist view, so I'm not prepared to concede that that translation is correct.
How would you like to translate Dharma?
Well, I still kind of like phenomenon, actually. But let's just translate it as what arises.
Oh, I'm happy with that. Okay. So, what did Nagarjuna have to say about the trying to determine the ontological status of what arises?
So what the text says is, in effect, if you say it exists, that's a mistake. If you say it doesn't exist, that's a mistake. If you say both, that's a mistake. If you say neither, that's a mistake.
Yes. So, what do you conclude from this?
How about this? That nothing stands on its own. That everything exists...
No, that's not the question.
Mm-hmm.
The question is... From Nagarjuna's point of view... How... What possibilities are there for determining the ontological status of experience? No, you said, if you say it exists, that's a mistake. If you say it doesn't exist, that's a mistake. If you say it exists and it doesn't exist, that's a mistake. And if you say it neither exists nor doesn't exist, that's a mistake. That's classic four gates. So, what do you conclude from this?
Suppose we conclude that it's impossible. We can't determine the ontological status of what arises.
Exactly. But that's exactly what you're trying to do.
When you say that this is a dream,
yeah,
aren't you making a statement about the ontological status of what arises?
No.
please help me understand why not.
Now, the point that, and the reason I'm going into this in this detail is because it's very, very important. Our way of thinking in, largely in the West, though I'm not as conversant as French, German, and Italian, and other languages as I am in English, that our language and our way of thinking is largely ontologically based. Everything in Buddhism is experientially or epistemologically based. So, everything is a dream, is an instruction. It's not a statement about how things are. It's an instruction. And it's instruction to say, experience everything as a dream. From where I've come to in my own understanding, I've come to really appreciate Nagarjuna as saying, just forget about trying to determine the status of what you experience. It's impossible, you always end up in a rat's nest. What you can do is train yourself to experience things differently. And that is exactly what one's doing, in, as far as I can tell, in all Buddhist practice, whether Theravadin, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, whether it's particular techniques like taking and sending, or the Shamatha Vipassana, Mahamudra sequence, or Vajrayana with the Yidam practices and the energy transformation techniques and the six yogas and so forth. Not one bit of it is about knowing what is true, even though that kind of vocabulary crops up all the time. It's about experiencing things differently. Experiencing things in a way, as I said first evening, so that we don't struggle with experience. And it becomes quite extraordinary. So, we go back to your experience with taking and sending here. When one is ill, a way to experience that is to approach it in the instructions of Mahayana mind training, which is to say, here's the suffering that is arising, I'm ill. May all the illness and unhappiness and pain and misery of all beings come unto me. And may my happiness, health, and understanding go to all beings. What actually happens to you there, that is, the progression of the illness, that's not affected by the practice. It's affected by a lot of other factors. But the way that you experience the illness changes very significantly, because you no longer fight it. And so even though one is quite ill, one is clear and at peace. Now, clearly there was something quite seriously, you had quite a significant medical condition, and it kept unfolding and required greater and greater levels of intervention. But to ascribe that to this way of training your experience is a classical example of magical thinking. It's we often, I think frequently, approach practice with the idea that if I know the truth, then I will be at peace. It was quite a startling realization for me to recognize that that was completely wrong. Wrong on many counts. The most important one being there is no truth, which is said in Buddhism time and time again in various more elaborate ways. And so this business about knowing the truth is a complete pipe dream. And what I began to appreciate, and this particular formulation doesn't come from me, but comes from a previously rather obscure professor of economics at the London School of Economics. Until he wrote a certain book that got him into all kinds of hot water in England. But it's a very good book. Religions are not claims to truth, but ways of learning to live with what we cannot know. Okay, and we don't know how long we're going to live. We don't know when we're going to die. We don't know how our life is going to unfold 5 years from now, or even tomorrow. How do we live with that? And there is no way of knowing, because stuff happens. We think we can have everything nicely ordered and in place, and something happens and everything's turned upside down. Well, what happens in Buddhist practice is that we train ourselves to open to whatever arises. That's what we're training ourselves to do. So we experience the world in a very, very different way. We don't experience the world in terms of expectations and goals and achievements and things like that. It is a radically different way of experiencing things. And it gives us the ability to meet whatever arises with a certain degree of equanimity, say, and warmth, joy, and understandings and compassion. You're very familiar with these. So, I think it's very, very important for us at this point to understand this is about experiencing things differently. Now, when there are experiences which arise, that is, there you sit, and the mind not only becomes still, and I want to change. See, mind means the way we experience things. So let's get rid of the word mind for a few moments. The way that we experience things becomes very still and open. And in that stillness and openness, there's no experience of something other. Does this mean that there is no I and no other? No, it is a way of experiencing. But that way of experiencing makes such a difference and has some, and is so profound and so impactful that people label it as the truth, when actually it's just another way of experiencing. Not only do they label it as the truth, they celebrate it. And one of the most elaborate celebrations of it is the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is like 1,000 pages. You know, celebrating impermanence as change and the joy of change, and suffering as opening into the intensity or bliss of experience, and emptiness as the interdependence of everything, so that we're all connected. There's just thousands of pages of celebration. Avatamsaka. It's been translated into English a couple of times, I think. Flower Garland, or the Flower Wreath Sutra, is the... But there are many, many others. The Prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom in 100,000 lines, is a celebration of this, you can't say anything about anything. and it just goes on for 100,000 saying this, because they're just blown away by this. And then the human mind does. Somebody says, this is how things are. Somebody else says, that's the truth. And now the fixation comes. And that screws everything up, as we know, time and time again. And so you get Saraha coming along saying, well, those who believe in reality are stupid, like cows. But those who believe in unreality, they're even stupider. And he's absolutely right, because they've moved from this way of experiencing things to saying, this is how things are. So, I think Buddhism is extraordinary and wonderful in that somehow through the ages it's done several things, and it's done them extremely well. One is, it's maintained the vitality and validity of experience over the written word in a way that very few other religions have. So the experience of contemporary masters has always been regarded as on par with the sutras. And very, very few other religions is that the case. Secondly, it has preserved the vitality of actual practice. Extraordinary. In all of the major traditions. I mean, every now and then there's a little hiccup, and so things get bogged down in China, and so you have this new school which calls itself the meditation school, which now we now know as the Zen school. But Zen is the Japanese version of the Chinese word chan, which is the Chinese version of the Sanskrit word dhyana, which means meditation. So you have this... Buddhism had bogged so down in China that you had this school which called itself, we're calling ourselves the meditation school. That's how absent meditation was from Buddhism at that point. And we had similar things in Tibet and elsewhere. And the Thai forest tradition represents a similar movement in the Theravada and so forth. And it happens. But it's maintained that vitality of actual practice as opposed to scriptural authority, philosophical categorization and things like that. And the other thing that Buddhism has done extraordinarily well is move from culture to culture, and brilliantly. In transition and transition, you know, so it goes to China, becomes one thing, goes to Japan, becomes something quite different, goes to Sri Lanka and Thailand, and quite different, and then you go to Mongolia and the regions around the Caucasus and the old Russian Buddhist monasteries, etc. And now it's coming to the West, becoming something totally different. But it does that. And all through all this, it maintains this kind of vitality. But if we start latching onto it in terms of truth and this is how things are, then we just get into a mess and actually create conflict and suffering in that. It's all about learning the possibility of experiencing what arises without struggling with it. And having learned that possibility, then actually cultivating it in one's own experience. And if one can cultivate it to the point that it's stable in one's experience, that is the end of suffering. Is that easy? No, it's not particularly easy. But the end of suffering is not a state. It is a way of experiencing what arises. So were you setting me up here? You don't have to answer. Pass the microphone.
He took my question.
That's between the two of you. But look at that. You got an answer, no?
Although if he does sending and taking as good as it seems, I hope he does it right now. And I'll sit right here.
Okay.
I wanted to ask about how obstacles get stuck in the body, which is where I am in my own practice, and I think where I've always been in that. I think that I'm doing something about my mind or with my meditation, but I keep finding that the obstacles to clarity and freedom are actually held in the body, and I find them there. And I just find them as sensations, really, without any other content. I had one of those, which was a pain in my heart that ached in various ways, which I sat with for almost 15 years. And I'm feeling a different one now. So I'm wondering, how is it that these things get stuck there? And how is it that just noticing them seems to unbind something in a way that creates a relative liberation?
Okay. The best book which provides a modern explanation for that, and I think it is quite a good book, is called The Trauma Spectrum by Robert Scaer, which is S-C-A-E-R. It's his second or third book, but the first one is something the body. But The Trauma Spectrum covers all of that material in a better way, and he goes actually into exploring a lot of spiritual phenomena from the point of the neurology and physiology of the body, and I think it's pretty solid. I have my own fairly rough theories about that. And there are people here who are very, very good at, and this is their work, is helping people form a different relationship with stuff that's stuck in the body. And four or five people here who, that's their work, and they're very good, and I know them, that they're really good at it. I don't want to name names because I don't want to embarrass them, but I can tell you who they are afterwards. So let me respond to the second part of your question, because that's the really operational one. And this may sound a little woo-woo, but it's the best I can do. Something happens at some point in our lives in which we encountered an experience, frequently negative, but sometimes it can be a positive experience, which we had insufficient capacity to actually experience. So there's an undischarged emotional energy. And that often that goes into the body, and don't ask me how it goes into the body, that's why I referred you to Scaer. It frequently goes where there is weakness in the body, where there's already a tendency for energy to stagnate. And where that is just depends on people. Many different factors. And where there's stagnant energy in the body, and this is borrowing from the Chinese medical tradition, stagnant energy tends to attack. So that weakness festers and prevents the natural flow of energy in the body. Over time, anything which resonates with that undischarged emotional energy triggers mechanisms to protect that experience from coming into awareness, because it wasn't able to come into awareness originally. So there are layers and layers on top of this. And one of the best versions of that is Sleeping Beauty. That's what the story of Sleeping Beauty is about. Is the princess poisoned, she goes to sleep, and these hedges, impenetrable brambles, arise, which prevent anybody from entering. And the prince in those stories always symbolizes awareness or attention, and the female symbolizes the knowing, and the attention has all of the stuff to get in the way and can't get through. And there are many, many stories with that theme, but Sleeping Beauty is one of them. As we practice, one of the things that we're doing in practice is raising the level of energy in attention. And as the level of energy rises, what operates at lower levels of energy ceases to disturb. So we all know that when we sit down to practice, the first thing we realize is we're just completely distracted by thoughts. They're all over the place. It's because our attention has insufficient energy and is disturbed and distracted by thoughts. But as we cultivate more and more attention or higher level of attention, then thoughts come and go. They don't disturb the quality of attention itself. And eventually, there may be movement in the mind, but there's no disturbance in the attention. That's what I mean about levels. As the level of attention, energy and attention rises, attention penetrates deeper and deeper into the system. And so it starts penetrating those layers. And that's where we experience a lot of confusion and pain and disturbance and a great deal of reactivity, because that's what's stored in those layers. That's what those layers consist of. And through this process, we may come, and it sounds like you've had this experience, where you experience that undischarged emotion. And for some people, it rises, when they experience that, it brings real memories and associations. But that's not always the case. In my case, I very rarely get any memories, associations, but I have these rather intense emotional experiences, like really, really intense. And then something that has been there for a very long time is no longer there. But it sounds like you know what I'm talking about. And if you... It's been nicknamed the Big Green Book. Not by me. At the end of chapter 5, section 10, there's actually a fairly detailed description of this whole process, if you're interested. Essentially that's what one is doing in practice. Now, when you're doing things like cultivating the four immeasurables, you're raising the attention by significant levels. Developing those kinds of emotion, relationship with those kinds of emotions. When you're doing a yidam practice, that's jacking up the level of energy still higher. And the six yogas and such are all about developing very high states of energy, with the intention that you now have the sufficient level of attention to be able to experience whatever is there. When we have a lot of this stuff in our background, this is not a smooth process. and the up the emotional ups and downs and how painful it is usually left out of the traditional descriptions. It's just described as some nice, you know, happy journey to nirvana. But and I'm going to introduce something I was discussing with somebody earlier in this retreat. One of the phrases that you find in the Vajrayana, which I find very intriguing, is wisdom resides in the body. And it's only by experiencing this stuff in our body that we can be free. Experiencing it intellectually or even emotionally isn't enough. That stored emotional charge in the body has to come out. And sometimes you may find that when you're touching that, your face will contort in certain expressions, or even your body will move in certain ways. It'll want to move. And that's all part of the discharge that's taking place. And I don't know whether you've read The Life of Pi. Well, at the beginning of The Life of Pi, this young man is in India, and he goes around and he forms a relationship with all of these religions. But then he asks this great question. You've got your choice of two icons, and these are arguably the two most powerful icons in the world. You have Buddha sitting in meditation, utterly at peace, earth witness, mudra, touching the ground. And you have Christ hanging on the cross. And he said, why would anybody choose Christianity? Well, here's my theory. And I think Christianity was seriously distorted quite early in its evolution. When you go through the process that I'm describing, you're sitting in meditation, you may be just recognizing mind, and you find yourself encountering pain that you wouldn't wish on your worst enemy. And you know, you think, it feels like you're being crucified. And it's physical pain as well as emotional pain. You have to open to the body. If you try to ride above the body, nothing ever changes. There's always that level of stuff that isn't touched. And you can see it in people and in teachers if they haven't done it, because there's something that's missing. There isn't a connection with the ground. Do you know what I mean? So you have to come into the body to experience the pain that is there, the pain that blocks you from knowing and experiencing what you actually are. Do you follow? And so, from this point of view, what the image of Christ on the cross represents is the spirit coming into the body to experience the pain that is there in order to be free. And I think at some level people feel that that's what's going on. That's why they connect with that image. Because it is a very, very powerful image, and people do connect with it, but often not in a way that they understand very clearly. So, this is a response to your question.
Can you suggest working?
And you suggest working with that through the body as well as from the top or from awareness coming into the body, but working with the body to have it be felt through the body.
Yeah. When you take Mahamudra, for instance, the way it is presented in the Tibetan tradition, very little mention is made of the body. And because of that, very, very few people really connect with the practice. What happens is that if this is the undischarged emotional material, as their attention develops, then when it starts to hit or penetrate that undischarged emotional material, one of two things happen. They either go down and they go into depression and get very, very depressed, but it's a way of avoiding this material. Okay? And they may get sick and all kinds of things. Nobody knows what to do, and everybody thinks, well, that's your bad karma, and that's that. Basically. Sorry, I've been on the receiving end of it. I know it. The other thing that happens is that they go up. And they go into quite high states of clarity and emptiness or non-thought or bliss. But it's all about avoiding that undischarged emotional material. And the consequence is that those high states are relatively unstable. Unfortunately, in most Dharma center context, people get rewarded for that. And this material is never penetrated. And it's for this reason that, and you've heard me say this many times, even just in this first couple of days of this retreat, always go to the body. Whatever your practice, whether you're doing bare attention, whether you're doing taking and sending, whether you're doing yidam practice, whether you're doing six yogas or whatever, always go to the body. Because that's where you're going to find out what's happening. And people say, well, how do you do yidam practice in the body? Well, it's very simple. You know, there you are, imagine your Chenrai Zi. What does your body say about you being the embodiment of awakened compassion? Well, most of the time the body says, let me out of here. And now you're dealing with your how it actually feels to you. But very, very few people practice yidam practice that way.
That's actually how it happened to me. I was on a long yidam retreat and I couldn't not feel it. So then I got stuck. Got depressed. It's just exactly what you said.
Yeah.
The way that it happened.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. You. You're very welcome.
So, as you know, I'm more familiar with the Dzogchen way of saying things, and I'm learning.
Yeah. Try it out. I'll see. I'll see if I can keep up.
No. I'm learning more some of the Mahamudra ways of describing things,
mm-hmm.
And so the idea of watching mind move. Is it something I've heard a lot about in the past? And it seems like something that's very helpful. And it seems like I've heard the statement, practicing with mind moving and with mind stillness. So I was wondering if you could say something about that.
Oh, that's right out of Dzogchen.
Yeah, they just don't say it exactly like that.
Oh, that's pretty close. So, you really want this?
Well, yeah. So here's the thing. So so a thought arises, and you recognize this is mind moving. And what it is that's aware that mind has moved, that doesn't move, right?
Charles, you've infected her. For shame. Try again. You've made a philosophy out of it.
No, and one of the prayers that I really work with a lot is the primordial ground of one's own awareness is unchanging and unmoving. Whatever arises as the expression of Dharmakaya is neither good nor bad, etc. So I'm trying to tell if we're saying the same thing there.
Okay. This is wonderful. And your question takes us to what's a very, very important point. Say those two lines again.
The primordial ground of one's own awareness is unchanging and unmoving. Whatever arises as the expression of Dharmakaya is neither good nor bad.
Okay. Is that a statement of fact?
It's a statement of experience.
And approach it as a way of experiencing things.
Yeah.
Now, as such, it is a result. Can you practice a result?
No.
Okay. So you don't even try to practice that. Because you can't. And yet, you have no idea how many people try to do that.
Yeah.
And it just really makes a mess. What is the corresponding method for that result? What is the corresponding method for that result? What is the method of practice which will give rise to that way of experiencing things?
Watching mind move.
Is that a question? No, I'm asking the question here.
So that's
the You're allowed to say I don't know.
Yeah, well, it seems like that is what it is.
It's watching the mind move.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
No.
Do you want to continue or are you retracting? I'm being very kind
well,
here.
The primordial ground of one's own awareness.
No, we're past that.
Okay.
We're into the watching the mind move. Yes. Do you want to stay with that, or do you want to retract?
I'll stay with it.
What watches the mind move?
So that would be that primordial ground, right?
You see what I mean,
watches
Charles.
Watches the mind move.
Totally infected. Let's try this again.
It's non-conceptual mind. No.
Worse.
No, it's the observing mind that watches the mind move. Teach me.
Pardon?
Teach me.
Let's try it again. What watches the mind move?
Awareness.
It's a tiny little bit better. What was happening before you said awareness?
Looking, just looking.
Go on, describe that. You're looking.
Seeing anything in particular.
Yeah. That's the method. That's the method. It's not watching the mind that moves. That's not the method. When I asked you what watches the mind move, everything stopped.
Yeah.
That's the method.
Okay.
Now, you work with that. And see, what happened the first time I asked the question is you just skipped over that and went into all these nice concepts which have nothing to do with anything. They're just garbage. Sorry. And so second time, you hung out there for a little bit, but you couldn't stay there. What happened?
I went into trying to figure it out.
Yeah, okay, but this is important. Before you started figuring out, what happened? There are four things that happen here.
Well, I don't really know.
Okay. First thing is we look. Because the effect of the question is to make us look. Mm-hmm. Right? And then, like Alice, we see nothing. That's the first thing that happens. Well, first thing is we look. Second thing is we see nothing. The next thing that happens is we panic. As Nietzsche said, when you stare into the abyss stares into you. And when you look at nothing, it's not too far along there that you begin to get the sense that you are nothing. And you panic. That's not allowed. That's not written in the contract. So you panic. And to get out of that panic, you go to the conceptual mind and come up with all these brilliant philosophies and explanations which are worth the paper they're written on. Follow? So, what the practice consists of is looking. Now, initially, our attention isn't very stable. So that's why we do all kinds of other practices in order to develop a sufficiently stable attention and to clear out the big emotional blocks and things like that so that we have some possibility of actually resting in that looking. And as we're able to rest in the looking, we find that we're able to look in the resting. This is not about watching the mind. That is, I mean, that's exactly what Nick was asking about, actually. Some use their ability to know movement as mind, that's watching the mind, to mull over the traces as thoughts and feelings ebb and flow. People who track arising and fading in stable meditation just spin in confusion, even if they practice for 100 years. This is Jigme Lingpa, by the way. Okay. This help?
Very helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
It's, the method really isn't that different, then. I mean, that's a chin instruction right
Pardon?
There. That's a chin instruction right there is to look, so thank you.
Well, as Nishu Kempo said, I did a retreat with Nishu Kempo in Santa Fe many, many years ago. And a couple of interviews with him, and one of them, he said, I mentioned this, but I'll mention earlier in the retreat, but I'll mention it again. He said, Ken, Mahamudra and Dzogchen are two names for the same person. Did you understand? Yes, Rinpoche. Mahamudra and Dzogchen are two names for the same person. Did you understand what I said? Yes, I did, Rinpoche. Mahamudra and Dzogchen are two names for the same person. Do you understand what I'm saying? He went on for about 10 minutes like this. And your turn.
I'm looking for an answer that will be equally enlightening.
No pressure, I see. Which arm do you want behind my back?
Two or three weeks ago, I was dealing with some intense emotional reactions, and looking for some way to approach them, I, of course, got out the big green book. And I thought that the meditation on dakinis would be helpful. So I did use that, and what I found was that I had a very strong identification with the dakinis, as if they were a part of myself rather than something outside of me. And so I have several parts to this question. One is whether that's okay, because I know that it's not how the meditation is written.
Let's answer that question right now. We can take these in parts. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. No, I'm okay, thank you. Yes. Page 214.
Did I get it wrong?
Crystal Dakini guards against interruption. Jewel Dakini increases wealth. Lotus Dakini gathers energy. Action Dakini gets everything done. When wanting and grasping hold sway, the Dakini has you in her power. Wanting nothing from outside, taking things as they come, know the Dakini to be your own mind. The essence of mind is knowing. Know that the crystal is the non-thought of mind itself, and the crystal Dakini guards against interruptions. Know that the source of wealth is contentment, and the jewel Dakini fulfills all wants and needs. Know that the lotus is the non-thought of freedom from attachment, and the lotus Dakini gathers energy. Know that action has no origination or sensation, and the action Dakini gets everything done. Those who do not understand these points can practice for eons and know nothing. So the heart of the matter is to know that the Dakini is your own mind. This is sung by Dakini, lion-headed Dakini, in fact, to Trungpa Noger back in the 11th century. So I think you're in good company.
So I remember reading that, but those instructions weren't actually in the meditation. So okay, so the next question. In working with this, the issue of gender came up for me, whether it would be useful to have a Dakka instead of a Dakini. And I tried that out because the energy seems really different. If you're identifying with something versus if it's something outside of yourself. And that didn't work for me at all. And this is kind of idle curiosity at this point.
That's a bit more than idle curiosity. It's an important point.
So I wondered, and as you were saying a little bit earlier, in fairy tales, the male figure is the attention, and the female figure is often, I think you said, knowing or wisdom. And I wondered if there's something kind of essential there that comes out in how the meditations are structured and in fairy tales and everything. And one of my motivations isn't only my own experience, but in talking about these kinds of meditations with other women, sometimes it comes up whether you should be changing gender or not.
Yeah. There are meditations in which one is working with the transformation of sexual energy, where gender considerations do come up. But in terms of the Dakini, Dakas and Dakinis, and in terms of Yidams, the gender isn't the issue. There's a symbolic symbolism here which seems to run quite deep in the human condition. With the woman or the female, feminine, whatever, representing knowing or wisdom and emptiness, and the masculine representing form, attention, structure, and so forth. I remember at I was at a Buddhist teachers conference in the mid 90s, and a woman got up to talk about this and went on a rage against the sexism in Tibetan Buddhism. And she was just completely off the mark. Because, I mean, for instance, Kala Rinpoche's successor, Boka Rinpoche, had an intimate relationship, very, very intimate relationship with Green Tara. And Kala Rinpoche's own teacher was the tailor. After he'd done the three-year retreat, he was the tailor at the monastery. You know, and after a couple of years of sewing banners and things like that, he said, this is just a waste of time. Now, Tibetan monasteries weren't the easiest places to practice, because there was a lot of work to be done. And that was so he locked himself in one of the toilets, the latrines. And you really don't want to know what the latrine of a Tibetan monastery was like. And he prayed to Tara, Green Tara, actually. And he stayed there for 7 years. After a while, they stuck food under the door for him. But that was his practice. Dajin Rinpoche, as I mentioned earlier, formed this very, very close relationship with Chenrezig. And if you look through the teachers over the generations, some of them it's Vajrayogini, some of them it's Chakrasambhara. Female teachers meditate on male teachers meditate on female or male. It just goes back and forth. There isn't any gender thing. It's much more a matter of personal connection. Let me say a word about the practice, because twice you've used the phrase something outside of you. You may recall the discussion I just had with Charles about the ontological status of things, right? In what sense is the Dakini outside of you?
Well, it seems that how the meditation is set up.
Yes.
Is you have somebody approach you.
Yes. In what sense is that figment of your imagination outside of you?
Well, I'm with Charles on this one.
And where are you, Charles? Now, look.
I didn't really mean that.
Yes,
can I really answer?
Pardon?
Can I really answer?
Yes.
So, I understand that it's a figment of your imagination and it's in your head. But
it's not in your head.
It's in my body.
That's just as bad as saying it's outside. It's not in your head.
Let me try one more time.
Please.
So it's part of my experience that I am... No, I'm just going to stop. So here's the distinction I was trying to draw, though.
Okay.
When I... The meditation has the Dakinis looking into your eyes and you're looking into the Dakini eyes. And for me, it was like looking into myself. And the reason that she knows everything about me is because she is me, except for without all the garbage, you know, the reactive stuff. And that was extraordinarily powerful for me, and actually gave me a feeling of power, meaning that I was, you know, able to act in ways that I normally wouldn't act, for example. And that was just really profound for me. Whereas when I started doing it, it didn't have that impact on me. It was more like, well, here's this, how I felt. I know that it's obviously, but how I felt was, here's this idea that I'm creating outside of myself, and they're going to pour all this elixir in me, and I'm going to be okay. I mean, it was very superficial, and I know that's not how it was supposed to work, but at the beginning that's how it felt. And then when it felt like it was me, it was explosive. I mean, it was so amazing.
So what happened to change that?
I got to my favorite emotional reaction and realized that the Dakini was a part of me that I've identified in the past.
Just so. This goes back to some of the things I was talking with Michael about. What you've described is exactly how these practices work. When you started the practice, you did not have any connection with this aspect of yourself. Right?
I don't think I agree with that. I think I had a connection.
Pretty tenuous. Could you move there whenever you wanted?
Well, it would be
just
more
bear with me and then you'll see where I'm going. What these kinds of practices do is dramatize a process which is taking place in us all the time. They dramatize it. We act it out in order to form a connection with it. Because most of the time we don't have a connection with it. So there's the Dakini. She looks at us. We look at her. And we feel known in that way, which is exhilarating and intimidating at the same time. She pours the elixir, we make a gesture to say that we're interested in this transformation, pours the elixir in. Our level of attention rises, because that's what the elixir symbolizes. We become aware of this massive reactivity going on in us. But as we become aware and we're imbued with the energy of that elixir, we're able to experience all of that reaction, and within the reaction we find, let's say, the earth Dakini, a stability that doesn't require an external reference. And that opens the possibility of balanced, pristine awareness, etc. You know how it works. We do this a few times, and as we form this connection and we become familiar with this, and in your case, provided a little extra juice by your favorite emotional reaction. Okay? It's like, oh, this is me. And now it's no longer something you're visualizing or imagining outside happening to you. You recognize, oh, this is something that has always been in me and I haven't known it. Or I haven't had access to it before. And now you can continue to do the practice, but it has a very different quality to it. Is that fair?
I realized while you were talking that although I've had, I think, a relationship with this part of me in the past, that and she would be able to act on my behalf, if I can put it that way.
Yes.
In some situations, that in other situations she couldn't. And so you're talking about being made whole.
Yeah, she becomes more available to you now, right? Yeah. Okay, very good. Is that all your questions?
Yes.
Was that said out of fear or relief?
I'm having a real difficult time formulating this question because I don't understand why it's so important to me.
Okay.
So maybe I'm going to have to go into some history.
Go straight to the question first and then okay. See what we have to fill in.
I feel loss, frustration, need, and it seems to have to do with wanting a something. I really want a something. A label, a concept, a construct, that kind of something. I've lost, as you know, the remainder of a mythic perspective on practice. And what you were talking about very directly about what is true is not true, it's only what's experienced. That, reformulation of what practice is about and what the goal is, there's a something that I want still.
Yeah.
So the mythic perspective is gone, and the mythic perspective and the modern perspective shared in me what I've thought of as a mystical viewpoint. You can have a mystical viewpoint in both of those. But where I am now, I've outgrown the mystical perspective, but I don't know where I am. I want a thing there.
Yeah. I suggest that you might consider that you haven't grown out of the mystical perspective, but you've grown into it.
Well,
and there's no ground at all.
There is no ground at all.
Yeah.
And I keep trying to throw something there that is reductionistic, and that's what I'm trying to avoid. This is a little bit long, but I hope you'll bear with me. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility only in the world of speculation. What might have been and what has been point to one end, which is always present. Footfalls echo in the memory down the passage which we did not take towards the door we never opened into the rose garden. My words echo thus in your mind. But to what purpose disturbing the dust on a bowl of rose leaves, I do not know. Other echoes inhabit the garden. Shall we follow? Quick, said the bird, find them round the corner,
Through the first gate into our first world shall we follow the deception of the thrush. Into our first world, there they were, dignified, invisible, moving without pressure, over the dead leaves in the autumn heat, through the vibrant air. And the bird called in response to the unheard music in the shrubbery, and the unseen eye-beam crossed, for the roses had the flower look of flowers that are looked at. They were there as our guests, accepted and accepting, so we moved, and they, in a formal pattern, along the empty alley into the box circle to look down into the drained pool, dry the pool, dry concrete, brown-edged, and the pool was filled with water out of sunlight. And the lotus rose quietly, quietly. The surface glittered out of heart of light, and they were behind us, reflected in the pool. Then a cloud passed, and the pool was empty. Go, said the bird, for the leaves were full of children hidden excitedly, containing laughter. Go, 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 said the bird. Humankind cannot bear very much reality. Time past and time future, what might have been and what has been, point to an end, which is always present. Well?
I don't have any words. I've got little tears, but I don't have any words.
So, funny thing happened in evolution. As human beings evolved, they developed abilities, or they developed capacities, which allowed abilities to develop which had nothing to do with survival on the Serengeti. And among these, and music was possibly another one, but is this capacity we have to experience things in a very, very different way. And I want to emphasize the use of different as opposed to superior or higher. And the word paramita, which in Tibetan is paraltachimba, means over there. Paro means there, chin, so it's go over there. So it's going to a different way of experiencing things, a different way of doing things. And within the paramita, there isn't really that idea that it's in the word itself, that it's superior or higher or deeper or any of that stuff. It's different. And when we discover in ourselves that different way of experiencing things, and as we've talked about earlier, it's extraordinarily significant, and people both wrote these vast treatises celebrating it. For some people, it's what makes their life meaningful. For some people, each of us seeks a different way of experiencing the world, each for our own reasons. I don't think it's the same for any two of us. And then we find it. And then we find out how much of the conditioned person, human being, just ain't up to it and doesn't want to have a thing to do with it, even though it is tremendously valuable and appreciated and held. Other parts of us, like, you know, I want that back or something. You remember in the Shangpa tradition, the four faults of mind.
The four thoughts that turn the mind?
No, the four faults.
Four faults.
So close, you can't see it. So deep, you can't fathom it. So fine, you can't accept it. So simple, you can't believe it. So simple, you can't believe it. Oh, it's all in here. Oops, sorry. You know, that's chapter 9 or chapter 10, I can't remember. Oh, I'll find it for you. I think it'll be in the... George will have put that in the index, so it should be pretty easy. He left this one out. It's not under four either. Okay. It's chapter 9 or 10, that's for sure. It's more than likely chapter. Anyway, I'll look it up and find it for you later. So, and this is what T.S. Eliot's referring to, because that was the first part of Four Quartets I was reading. Go, 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 said the bird, because humankind cannot bear very much reality. And, I mean, you have some people who devote their life energy to opening to this, because it is intensely meaningful to them. You have others who happen upon it one way or another through their own efforts, sometimes by accident. And it's very, very valuable to them because it allows them to live a different way. But they don't necessarily try to hold on to its experience all the time. And there are other people who encounter it and they just have no time for it. They don't have anything to do with it.
I don't know what to say about that because it is everything
to you. And in the bigger scheme of things, none of us has any right to tell others how they should experience the world. And this is why in spiritual practice, all efforts have to be volitional.
The one of the four that really speaks to this dilemma is it's too simple to believe.
It's too simple.
It's like coming out of something that was precious and difficult. And
that's all? Yeah. I mean, and there are people through the centuries, you know, pointing out instructions. That's it. And there are other people, they go, oh, I had no idea. And these are just different reactions. The traditional explanations, it depends on your karma. But people react to this in very, very different ways. That you know what it means to you. That's all that matters. And yes, it'd be nice to have some ground to walk on sometimes. It'd be nice to have that old external reference to tell me that I was, there was something on my right hand side instead of just empty space and no reference point, and now I've got to figure out what to do with this situation.
The difficulty is there's nowhere to go, but I have to go.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time, there's freedom. So it's not all bad.
wasn't saying it was any bad.
Okay. Just wanted to underline the point.
But there's a something that you touched on when you said people react differently because they have different karma. The last discussion we had about what it meant to be on a Buddhist path, living a Buddhist life, you were struggling with whether you had to believe in rebirth and multi-lifetime karma.
That's a very long time ago. What was that discussion?
Like I said, it's been, I think, 2 years.
Yeah.
What have you done with that?
I mean, I haven't been struggling with past, future lives for... That ceased to be an issue many, many years ago. But... to answer your question... gradually allowed myself to get used to it. Gradually allowed myself to get used to it. To what she's talking about.
The incarnation?
No, the groundlessness. When it switches, it switches.
Yeah.
And you don't really get to go back. So, and most irritatingly, you still have to navigate life. Life doesn't stop and say, okay, we'll just give you time. Break! You know, time out. It doesn't work that way, unfortunately. There's actually quite a lot of material in the literature about adjusting. And so we can talk about that sometime if you want.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I think we should. Everybody had a chance? Tomorrow night, it's 20 to 9 already. So let's just sit for a few minutes together. Till tomorrow, Gary, till tomorrow.
All rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.